Joshua Wolfshank is a curator, essayist, and award-winning author who's written for just about every top publication you can think of, Atlantic, Harper's, The New Yorker, and many others. His first book, Lincoln's Melancholy, was a best book of 2005 by The New York Times, and he serves on the board of Penn Center USA. Josh also has taught creative writing at the New School and New York University, and has been a keynote speaker at numerous institutions on subjects ranging from creativity, relationships, and mental health. He's currently the executive director at the Literary Center at UNLV. Joshua Wolfshank, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, you and I, we met at the Bennington Writing Seminars in Bennington, Vermont, right?
We did, indeed.
That was like back in 2009.
Did two semesters at Bennington and then went off to write this book, actually.
Right.
And yeah, it was a tremendous community there.
Right, right. And now you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're the executive director of the Literary Center there at UNLV?
That's right. The Black Mountain Institute, which is International Literary Center. We do fellowships and public programs.
Wow.
Publish a literary journal and have all kinds of really interesting collaborations with institutions around the world.
Nice. How'd you like the UNLV heat out there?
The first month and a half was pretty amazing. It's 110 degrees all day into the night. I think, unlike Los Angeles, where I had been living for some years, the heat does not break here in the summer.
Right, right.
And it's astonishing. And I made this joke in L.A. It's all the more true in Las Vegas, that the ideal outfit would be that jumpsuit that the Max character wears in Annie Hall when he picks Woody Allen up.
Yes, yes.
When he picks him up from jail.
Right, right.
A full-on jumpsuit with a hood and then sunglasses in the hood.
Yeah, right, right. That's great, man. That's great. So we'll just jump right into talking about your book here. Now, I know that it's a fantastic book, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that you previously, about a year ago or a few years back, actually, you published a study called What Makes Us Happy. And then you published your first book, which was Lincoln's Melancholy, about Abraham Lincoln's battle with depression. And now you have this book, which in some ways is a study, I would say, like on social psychology of partnerships and maybe the creative world. You know, it seems that you've been immersed now for several years in the study of, you know, the human mind or psychology. You know, is that right?
That's a good description, yes.
Right, right. So what's your personal investment in the work, in this kind of study, this area?
The intersection of psychology and literature, you know, trying to be an essayist and, you know, a literary essayist, but working on the material of, you know, how people tick, why people suffer, what the wisdom traditions teach us about how to be a human being. These are my preoccupations, and I've tended in my career to be drawn to these big abstract questions and try to find stories that help me dig into them.
Right.
So the Lincoln book began with the question, how do we reconcile these two facts, that Lincoln was the most talented, ambitious, precocious guy in his circle, and also the most depressed.
Right.
And that same paradox of sorts shows up over and over again through history.
Right.
And I, as a young man who was quite depressed and very ambitious myself, I was fascinated by that question. And I thought, you know, telling the story of Lincoln's life would be a way of digging into it. This book, Powers of Two, also began with the question. In this case, the question is, when two people are doing something together far beyond what they could do alone, what's happening between them? What this thing we call chemistry or synergy, what is it?
Right.
And my thought was that if I looked at really closely at places where that chemistry clearly exists, I might learn, you know, I might sort of get to its kind of core ingredients.
Right.
And so I hatched this method with my editor, who was my partner on this book.
Right, right, yeah.
To study scores of hundreds of these relationships, of, you know, examples of what I came to think of as creative intimacy. And then that became a really curious thing to me, that intimacy, we ordinarily associate exclusively with romance or with friendship,
sure, yeah,
or
right.
familial relationships, but that we don't associate it with creative work.
Right, yeah.
When in fact, if you go beneath the surface, and this is my contention, if you go beneath the surface of anything, I mean, actually, I'm a little radical in this way. I think if you go beneath the surface of anything meaningful, that you will find a relationship operating. It may not be what we think of as collaboration. It may not be
right, yep.
two people who have contributed equally. It may be perfectly appropriate that only one person's name is on the work. Right. It may be perfectly appropriate that one person actually owns the work in the way that I own the copyright to my book.
Right, yeah.
But the relationship is critical, and people who don't know about them, I think, are really at a great disadvantage to do their own work.
Right, exactly. And I get all that from your book. And then also I was aware that about a year ago you published an article in the New York Times that was called The End of Genius, where you write that even Shakespeare had collaborators. You know, Shakespeare, who we all kind of perceive as this sort of the quintessential genius, right? He had collaborators, and he relied on the work of others. And then you talk a little bit about, in your article, about the images that we see on these sort of big billboards, that we see a picture of Einstein with his tongue sticking out, or
right.
Picasso staring straight into the camera. And the message that we get then is one of sort of solitary genius, right? But then you give us clear examples of how in each of these cases, each of these quote-unquote geniuses have worked with a collaborator in one way or another. Can you tell us a little bit about this myth of the solitary genius?
Right. So when you dig into the story of relationships, it runs you up against this myth. And by looking at Shakespeare is helpful because it is actually where the myth of the lone genius began, not in Shakespeare's life, but after his death. He was developed by first through what we call the Enlightenment period, and then especially by the Romantics as the quintessential lone genius. And it's really actually comical because Shakespeare was in the throes of this fantastically entwined world where he was drawing on stories that were, you know, either traditional stories or stories that were being presented to him.
Right.
He was writing his plays for particular members of a repertory company. There are instances in which he had, you know, what we would call co-writers, but even when he didn't, there was a constant exchange, as there often is in the theater, between the text on the page and what was spoken.
Right.
And it really is the sort of the very picture of kind of interdependency, let's say.
Right, right, yeah.
And yet many of us, you know, have this image of Shakespeare, you know, that's like the one in Shakespeare in Love, the movie, where he's, you know, in his garret with a candle lit, you know, writing with his quill pen.
Right.
And tortured.
Right, exactly. That's the idea. That's the image.
Hours pass, and then he finally produces a text, which he takes out and is performed to the word.
Right.
I'll say that the myth of the lone genius is actually not my core interest.
Sure.
But it is a blockage that it's like my real interest is getting out on the highway of this great highway of exploring relationships. But
right.
we're all at this roadblock, you know, which is this idea of the lone genius. And so you do have to, you know, get out of the car and,
right.
you know, get your tools out of the trunk of your car and start unscrewing the bolts of that thing.
Right, right, that's right.
In order to drive through it and to move on.
Right.
And so that's why I begin the book that way, saying, look, guys, this is just this made up notion.
Right.
And it actually doesn't apply when we look closely at relationships. It's also, then there's another myth that is also, I think, a blockage, and that is this myth of, you know, group mind, and, you know, that the only thing that matters other than the individual is the culture and the sort of, you know,
right.
this big swirling sea of humanity. That it is true that culture affects us in a huge way.
Right.
But if you look within cultures, what you see are people working in small groups, and very, very often the most potent group creatively is very often the dyad, the
right,
two people.
Yeah.
There's some
right.
some pretty commonsensical reasons why you see that.
Right.
So there's a reason why in the culture of the sort of big swirling culture of pop music in the late 50s, 1960s,
exactly.
that
yeah.
there's a band called The Beatles, and within
that's
the
right.
Beatles,
and I love
John
that.
And Paul are
right.
deliberately leaving the others behind to go write songs.
Probably the most popular dyad, right? I mean, you know, that's what pulled me into the book, and this will appeal to all the Beatles fans out there, you know, is that the prelude in your book is really an anecdote about how Paul McCartney and John Lennon composed the song with a little help from my friends. And then you use them as a sort of case study throughout the book. And that's obviously that was sort of probably a smart move, right? Using them as the prelude because it pulls you into and it sort of continues on throughout the narrative. I really appreciated that because it sort of just it just helped to illustrate, you know, what your point was in the book. And of course, you also talk a little bit about to some length about Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and their partnership as well. Were there any unusual partnerships that sort of just jumped out that you weren't aware of prior to your research and then you discovered throughout the process?
You know, it was a constant process of discovery to the point where, you know, I think actually the book suffers a little bit from overload. and it may have been a better book had I dug into a fewer examples with more, you know, with more detail and more feeling. It ended up being the way it is because, you know, it was just this constant experience of revelation. I can't believe there's another case where I thought, you know, where I only knew about one person.
Right.
Or I thought that there was, you know, the only thing was that's relevant is the group. And that there's this relationship operating. I mean, Einstein is an example of one revelation and the relationship that was operating in his life.
Right.
Gandhi, Martin Luther King,
yes,
Vincent van Gogh. You know, it just kept going on and on.
Right. Yeah, I bet.
And some of these relationships I couldn't get to the bottom of. You know, many of them are,
lifetime,
many of them are mysterious in the same way that, you know, if you think about your good friends, the couples in your midst, I mean,
right.
how much do you know about what really happens between them?
Sure, and right. Exactly.
There's a closing that happens between two people in intimacy that's actually definitional. That's part of what intimacy is,
right.
is that something is happening between you that other people don't get to share.
Right.
And that it interrupts our ability to study it from the outside.
I mean, like I wish I had read this book, you know, 20 years ago before I started my my path on writing and the arts, you know. But I even thought, man, this might even be like this should be part of like a prenup or something. People should like married couples should read this before they get married. You know, it's just this whole sort of synergy between two
different.
I did
learn a hell of a lot about my own relationships and friendship and
right.
my family and in you know, romance too and.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
I mean, this was like a you know PhD for me in the theory of things. Now applying it is
right.
a whole other piece of work, and
right.
I'm you know as humble as ever about
sure.
about that.
right.
About
you
that
know.
Challenge.
And on the back book cover of the book, you have a blurb by Andrew Solomon, who's the award-winning writer in New York Times. I wanted to just kind of share the blurb because I think it opens it up to all people in general and not just sort of those who are specifically interested in this type of subject. But what Solomon writes about your book is he says, Schenck banishes the idea of solitary genius by demonstrating that our richest art and science come from collaboration. We need one another not only for love, but also for thinking and imagining and growing and being. And like I said, I think that blurb really elevates the book beyond its, you know, its obvious pragmatic purpose to an almost, I mean, implying that this is a text that we can all apply to our way of life in some way or another, right?
I hope so.
What do you think?
I appreciate you seizing on that. I mean, I do think it's universal. And the word collaboration, which is often used in association with the book, I think is an unfortunate word because I think it feels very limiting to people and it feels like it doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it doesn't apply to many fields. I mean, the work of a writer is overwhelmingly the work of being in solitude.
Sure.
I am not arguing against that. There are a few you know, literary essayists or mm-hmm. novelists or poets who would say to you, you know, oh yeah, this is a work of collaboration. There are collaborations in literature, but they're a radical minority of the canon.
Right, that's right.
Or,
yeah,
or of any good book, of any series of good books.
Right.
What I'm saying though is that the capacity for solitude is activated by a relational experience, and that the work that is generated in solitude is often then requires a relationship in order to exist in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the front end and on the back end, you have these critical relationships. Now, they may actually, you could make the case that, you know, David Foster Wallace is a towering genius, and that Bonnie Nadel
right.
or Michael Peach, I'm referring now to his agent and his editor,
mm-hmm.
that they were minor players in relation to him. And I would not, I mean, maybe I would argue the case because it would be interesting,
right.
but I wouldn't say you're necessarily wrong. But right. the question is, could he have done what he had done? Could he have brought what he brought into the world without them? And, you know, you say, oh, well, you know, he's a genius. It didn't matter that Peach was there, you know? It didn't matter that Bonnie Nadel was there. Well, they were there.
Right,
okay?
Yeah, right.
They were there. And in every instance, there is someone like that there. And
sure.
when you look at people who go off the rails, when you look at people who stop producing, when you look at people who, you know, have more potential than is ever realized, one of the common characteristics is the absence of that.
Right.
You know, then the relationship becomes, and I think that we should, what we usually do is we say, okay, I'm assuming that there are geniuses and then everyone else is largely irrelevant. So prove right. to me the opposite.
Right.
And what I'm saying is we should assume that relationships are critical, and we should then try to understand them and
right.
and cultivate that understanding. If we want to understand the work that we care the most about,
right.
or if we want to make work ourselves to, you know, bring some, you know, I'm going to use the word, a strong word, to bring some reverence
right.
to this mm-hmm. question
absolutely.
About how these relationships are constructed. And it, you know, it's an ongoing question. I mean, I'm actually in a place right now, having written a book that was actually much more collaborative than most books are, where I'm trying to sort of dig into my own interior
right.
in a new way. And so that is a different journey than the journey of this book.
But it seems like it would probably still be an extension of this work, right?
Or like it is, and it, work, it, right? And it brings this question. So it's,
right.
who are the people that I can be in conversation with who can help draw out of me, you know, this thing that feels deeply me? Who are the people who can support me and help me feel safe while
right.
I go on these inner journeys? You know, it's
you need those allies, right?
yeah, it's like
right.
I think the constant and ongoing question, and I'm especially right. interested. There's a long section of the book about solitude and about the dynamics of solitude
wow.
and about what is creative solitude as opposed to, you know, just being alone and, you know, having white noise in your head.
Right, exactly. We've been speaking with nonfiction author Joshua Wolfshank about his new book, Powers of Two, How Relationships Drive Creativity, a wonderful book. Make sure you go out and pick that up. Thank you so much, Joshua Wolfshank, for being here with us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.